This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. State Attorney General Roy Cooper is in a unique position. He's the first Democratic Attorney General since Reconstruction to contend with an all-Republican government. Governor's Manchin and both chambers of the state's General Assembly are controlled by the GOP, and that means that Roy Cooper will sometimes find himself defending laws that he doesn't agree with. Roy Cooper has also expressed interest in running for governor in 2016, and Attorney General Roy Cooper is my guest now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about what we do when we have to professionally defend laws that we may not agree with. Take them one by one. You are in support of gay marriage, personally. You've come out and said that.
I support marriage equality. I do. And it's important for the state attorney general, regardless of the law that has been passed by the General Assembly, to do its duty to defend the state when it gets sued. And if there are constitutional arguments that are to be made, whatever the law is, then it is the duty of the Attorney General's office to make them. And I believe that that is an important part of my job. However, I think my ultimate duty is to the people of North Carolina, and that means that I'm going to speak out on policy that I believe is bad for the people, but also advocate policies that I think will benefit the people of North Carolina. And I have done that throughout my career as Attorney General. It's amplified now, obviously, because of the kinds of laws that this General Assembly has been passing, but I'm going to continue to do that.
Well, your critics will say that when you speak out in favor of laws or against laws that assembly has passed, or in favor of laws you'd like to see them pass, that it hurts your credibility, and they worry that you aren't going to do your job because you've been so outspoken.
There's a significant difference between arguing policy and arguing the law and the constitutionality of a law. These election law changes were very bad ideas, because they make it harder for people to register and vote. It was also a hodgepodge bill at the end of the session where dozens of changes in the law were put into place, some under litigation, some not, which were mostly all bad for the North Carolina electoral process. I warned the governor not to sign the law. He did anyway, and am going to continue to try to convince the legislature to make those changes. Now, judges know the difference between policy and arguing the constitutionality of the law. And our attorneys are experienced. They go in. I wasn't in favor of these redistricting changes that the legislature made, but our attorneys, when the state got sued, defended the state and defended the law, and so far have been successful.
Well, to walk us through that, I mean, how does that work? The federal government, right, the United States Attorney General, has sued the state of North Carolina for its voter ID law. It says that it's unconstitutional. You say you don't think it's a good idea. It's a hodgepodge and very bad policy. But you're somehow going to have to fight back against the Attorney General of the United States, who says it's unconstitutional. How do you draw that line?
Well, there's a difference between arguing the law and arguing public policy. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we agree with the provisions of the law that we are arguing. But if there are legal arguments to be made by the state of North Carolina, then it's the Attorney General's office. It's our duty to make them. You know, I ask you, would you want a law firm that's hired by the governor and the legislature, some private law firm, to be speaking on behalf of the state of North Carolina in court? I don't think so. What we want is consistency, and we want to make sure that the Attorney General is representing the state when someone sues on the laws that have been passed. And if the Attorney General decides that he or she doesn't like a law and therefore is not going to defend it, then your system crumbles and you become very inconsistent. You cost the taxpayers a lot of money by hiring outside attorneys, and that just doesn't work well.
Well, what about those? I mean, you talked about hiring outside attorneys. The governor and lawmakers have said they're going to have to do that because they don't trust you to defend the state. What's wrong with that? Why not have somebody who's more favorable, who thinks more favorably about the legislation?
Well, the governor and the legislature have hired outside attorneys for only one kind of case, And that's a political case and laws affecting the elections. They hired, the legislature hired an outside attorney for the redistricting case and for the election law challenges. The governor hired an outside attorney for the election law challenges. The rest of the cases that we have, the Attorney General's office solely is defending. I think there are a lot of legal arguments that the state may or may not want to make for consistency purposes, because there are many agencies and many laws passed by the General Assembly, and some may have inconsistent purposes. A central Attorney General office looks at those laws and makes decisions on what legal arguments should be made. And I think an outside law firm would not have that benefit of knowing what's going on across the state, would not have the central resources that the Attorney General's office has. So I think that's the best way to do it.
What does the law say about that, the federal law and state law governing who can represent a state? Can the governor appoint another somebody over the Attorney General?
North Carolina law says the Attorney General is to represent the state of North Carolina. That's the law, and I'm following the law.
Let's talk more about voter ID law and how you feel about it. And you said it's a hodgepodge. I mean, what and you've criticized this law. What's wrong with it?
Well, I take some issue at you calling it the voter ID law, because that's only one of dozens of changes that were made. In fact, if you had voter ID, there may be some discussion about what kind of ID you could use for policy purposes. Some of the people who advocated for this change talk about President Obama voting in Illinois and showing his identification as he was about to vote. But the law there allows different identifications to be used, such as utility bills. The policy of this is that you want to make it easier for people to register and vote. Obviously, you want to guard against fraud, but you want to make it easier. And the main thrust of this legislation was to make it harder for people to register and vote. Eliminated a pre-registration program for 16 and 17-year-olds in school. Shortened the early voting period. If you go to the wrong precincts with redistricting, that's easy to do. You can no longer cast a provisional ballot. It expands the number of people who can challenge you at a particular polling place. There's less disclosure now with this legislation. There's more big corporate money into the system with this legislation. It goes on and on, a hodgepodge of very bad ideas. And I believe the General Assembly, when they come back in May, should re-examine this, particularly after they've heard from people. They didn't get a chance to hear from people because they put this thing together in 48 hours and passed it with very little public input.
Interestingly enough, it did not address absentee ballots, which is the about the only area that we've indicated or any research shows there is fraud.
Well, I think it's unnecessary. This is unnecessary change in North Carolina public policy. We had moved from in the 40s to, I believe, and I'd have to check on this, but I believe we'd moved to 12th in voter turnout by 2008 because of the things that we'd done to expand people's ability to register and vote and make it easier and encourage more people to be involved in our democracy. What's wrong with that?
So if we have more people voting, do you want them to vote for you for governor in 2016?
Let me tell you, I am deeply concerned about the direction that our state is heading. Decisions that are being made by this governor and this legislature are not the North Carolina that we know and recognize. Significant cuts to public education, bad decisions about turning down 100% federal dollars that would have provided health insurance for 500,000 North Carolinians, would have provided jobs, would have added billions to boost the economy, getting involved in numerous divisive social issues that tear us apart instead of bringing us together, this bad voting law change. The list goes on and on. I'm concerned about it. It's a little too early for a formal announcement, but I intend to be a big part in trying to change our state, change the direction, and make sure that we move forward with ideas based on public education, jobs, and the economy, and let's get off of these divisive issues that's tearing our state apart and hurting our state brand both nationally and internationally.
What would be number one on your agenda as governor, should you run?
Public education is the economic engine that moves our state forward. I was talking to a CEO in a rural county who had about 400 jobs with his company, large number of unemployed people. He was having a difficult time matching the skill set with the jobs that he had. I had three members of the Board of Community Colleges there. He was trying to work with them to help him get the training for the people that he wanted to hire. They were sitting there with an $8 million cut to their budget. This governor, this legislature, don't understand the connection between public education and jobs in the economy. It's really a simple process, but they instead have taken the route of systematically and deliberately disassembling our educational system, with millions of dollars going to private school vouchers, cuts to the community colleges and higher education. It's very frustrating for a lot of people, and it's frustrating that the link to jobs in the economy is not recognized.
On the State of Things today, I am talking with the state's Attorney General, Roy Cooper. We will talk more about his political ambitions, what's right with the state, and what's wrong on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper, talking about some of the legislation that's been passed through this General Assembly. One of the most significant pieces of legislation was the repeal, in fact, of the Racial Justice Act. Tell us about how you feel about that.
There should be some law in place that helps the court system guard against that. I support capital punishment for particularly egregious first-degree murders. I think it is part of our criminal process that helps us to enforce the law and helps keep the public safe. But certainly it's unacceptable that there may have been racial components to any of these convictions. Right now we don't have it at all. And so I think it would be important to go back and re-examine this and determine what we ought to put in place to guard against this in the future.
Well, let me ask you about that, because it's very clear that race is a factor when it comes to our entire judicial system, criminal justice system, and certainly with the death penalty, since death penalty was reimposed in 1977 when it was restarted, authorized in 76. 77% of the victims of people who were executed were white. So and that's only one of the many statistics. So now you had something in place that was able to review these cases to see if race was a factor. Four out of four cases we found that it was, and the ones that were adjudicated here in North Carolina. Now it's no longer law. You're in favor of the death penalty. In light of the fact that races play such an important part in sentencing, and in light of the fact that we have no review now, like the Racial Justice Act, should we abolish the death penalty in this state?
No, but there should be a process in place where we can examine the issue of race in particular cases. The issue with the Racial Justice Act is how far you can go in using statistics overall to determine bias in each and every case. That's where I think that we need to re-examine this, and we need to go back to the legislature and look at the best way to do this. There were several iterations of the Racial Justice Act through the process, and there was a process of intense negotiation, getting the people who were in the field, the defense attorneys, the prosecutors, the judges. How do we do it? When the Racial Justice Act first passed, almost every single person who had been convicted and had received a sentence of capital punishment filed a Racial Justice Act appeal. And I think most people looked at that and said that most likely that should not be the case. So what we need to do is to go back and examine it. Now, these cases are working their way through the court system, and our attorneys, once again, are representing the state in these matters as we are required to do under the law in all appellate cases.
As Attorney General, you're responsible for the State Bureau of Investigation. Spotlight for the past few years has been on a lot of problems with the SBI. Does the buck stop with you? Do you have
Absolutely.
To do something? What are you doing?
I'm very proud of what the State Bureau of Investigation and the Crime Lab have done. I ordered an independent investigation on after the Greg Taylor case on cases wherein blood was used in determining convictions. We found that there were problems with getting this information to the court system. Not problems with the science itself, but problems with getting this information turned over. We have gone in and made significant changes. We have passed 3 independent DNA audits with perfect scores. We now have more independently certified forensic scientists than any lab in the country. We've been internationally accredited and are about to be the only lab in the country that will have dual accreditation by 2 outside independent sources. We have now full-time attorneys in the lab, which was a problem before, making sure that they are consulting with the scientists and making sure the information is turned over. We made sure that everything is online, and technology we're using not only to code the evidence but to get all of the lab notes and all of the information to the court system to make sure that decisions are made fairly and justly. I feel very confident about where they are. We've taken a situation where there were problems, and we just didn't put a Band-Aid on it. And people, I think, wanted an instant fix to this. Because it had been happening for decades, it wasn't an instant fix. And we went in and systematically changed the whole process of the way evidence was handled and how legal decisions were made. And it's a very positive situation now.
What about the damage to the credibility of the law enforcement system? You know, recent articles in the NNO pointed out that a number of SBI employees who were responsible for those mistakes still have jobs. Doesn't this speak to the integrity of the process? Should we trust the law enforcement system if we find that people who are responsible for these things, even if you figured out the fix afterward, are still in their jobs?
Well, those are personnel matters, and many of these cases had multiple issues with multiple people involved. We've made good decisions regarding employees, and I think that the idea now is that we have to look forward and make sure that these issues don't occur in the future, and we have put those plans in place to make sure that happens.
Is it a good decision to leave people in place who are responsible for very serious errors that in many cases, in some cases, lead to wrongful conviction?
Well, you have to analyze each individual case and look at the individual employee, and I don't want to do that at this time because there are certain protections that employees have.
Well, I want to talk about a case that did happen under your watch, or you inherited. There were 2 attorneys in your office who were reprimanded by the state bar in the Alan Gell case for failing to turn over evidence. He was facing the death penalty. His conviction was overturned. The state bar mildly disciplined the 2 attorneys. Did you discipline them? Were they allowed to keep their jobs?
Well, this occurred before I was in office, I believe, if I'm recalling this case correctly. And I don't remember the particular situation and don't know if discipline was provided in those 2 cases.
Well,
this was a while ago.
The case was inherited, but it eventually went to your office while you were in office, and it was David Hoke and Deborah Graves who were the 2 attorneys.
I'm not going to comment on whether they were disciplined. They aren't in the office anymore.
We talked about all of these things. We've circled around some of the more important issues. Racial Justice Act, there is a deep sense in African-American communities that the system is stacked against them. We talk about the problems at SBI and some of the wrongful convictions. Do you think that our criminal justice system and law enforcement apparatus does have a credibility problem and that more needs to be done? There's something you as Attorney General and perhaps the governor as well can do to build confidence in this system.
Well, it's something that we need to continually work on. The issue here is that law enforcement and prosecutors across this state don't get enough credit for the great work that they do. You can pick out some cases that are problematic, but overall, they do a significantly good job across our state protecting the public on not enough resources. One of my concerns has been is that the legislature has not properly funded the court system, has not properly funded law enforcement and technology. Clearly, that will help things significantly.
Let's change subjects a little bit. You recently decided to appeal Duke Energy's 7.2% rate increase. It's the second time you've appealed it. What's going on? What's behind that?
Well, utility rates affect everyone. They affect consumers. They can affect businesses. As you know, all of the utilities in North Carolina are regulated, and the Utilities Commission decides the amount that they charge the people, and they decide also the profit margin that's provided to the shareholders. This is where we have had a dispute with the utilities across North Carolina, is how large should that profit margin be in difficult economic times and how it affects consumers. Our argument is that when you figure the profit margin, and in this particular case that we appealed, the profit margin was 10.5%. We believed that double-digit profits were too high and did not appropriately consider the effect on consumers. We got a very good ruling from the North Carolina Supreme Court, but the Utilities Commission took it, ended up with the same decision, but put some window dressing on it, a little more oomph behind their ruling. And so we've appealed it again. We hope that the North Carolina Supreme Court will give us even better guidance on how we should take consumer interest into account when deciding this profit margin. There are a lot of families and businesses that would love double-digit profit margins. I've discussed this matter with Duke. They're holding fast on it, but I think that it's the wrong decision for ratepayers in North Carolina.
Duke Energy has said they held hearings all over the state, and they went long into the night and listened and listened and listened, and they presented their case, and then the Rate Commission the Utilities Commission has given them the okay.
But you've got to look statistically and look at numbers as to how these rates and how this profit margin affects consumers. And you look at unemployment figures. You look at the fact that in North Carolina, we rank very high on the percentage of household income that goes to pay utility rates. Those are the things that weren't figured in to the return on equity or the profit margin. The utility companies have held fast that this issue is only about a capital issue. What does it cost them to get capital? Can they pay enough return on equity in order to draw capital at the best interest rates, which ultimately affect consumers? It's a very inexact science, and we had testimony that this rate should have been lower. We believe that when you look at how it affects consumers, when you look at the numbers, that it should be lower, and therefore the actual rates charged to consumers would end up being lower.
You know, it's interesting. I'm sure some people listening to this are saying, well, why should any business, I mean, to some extent, would they have to take into account the effect on consumers? You take a look at what the price point is, you make it, and if you're competitive, you're not, or not, you know, you sink or swim. In this case, it's important to take that into account because they are, in a sense, a legal monopoly, right?
They are a legal monopoly. They're regulated, and that's what the law says. The Supreme Court agreed that that's what the law says. The issue is how you apply it and what does it look like. We disagree with the decision that's been made, and I hope that the North Carolina Supreme Court will correct it.
And the point is, in this case, the advocate for the consumer would be the Attorney General of the state.
The public staff also actually has most of the duty here to represent consumers in the state. The Attorney General also has authority to step in when he or she believes that it's in the best interest of the people to step in. We disagreed with the public staff on this. The public staff wasn't on our side on this issue, and that's who represents the consuming public. So we were facing a little bit of a double whammy here. We were going against the public staff and the utilities. But we did win in Supreme Court. We got past the break point that you are supposed to take consumers into account, not when you just decide the overall rate, but when you specifically look at the return on equity or the profit margin. That's a big deal. We don't think that they can just say they applied it when you really can't show that they did.
Well, let's get back to this this potential 2016 gubernatorial race and how you see yourself in the state of North Carolina at the moment. You talked about education being the most important part. Of course, there were effectively cuts in education when you look at the impact of the way the budget was written. Those cuts came in large part because the legislature chose instead to make tax cuts. Now, you could have raised taxes or left them where they were and then funded education at a different level. You talk about wanting a more robust education budget. Where's the money going to come from? Do we have to look at taxes?
$2.5 billion in tax giveaways to the top 1% was in the budget passed by this legislature. That's a priority. That's a priority. When you talk about there's not enough money to fund public education, which is what we kept hearing, that's not true because they made the priority to enact those tax giveaways, and you effectively have a tax increase on many middle class and lower income people doing away with the earned income tax credit. People who are working hard in North Carolina, who are just striving to keep into the middle class, their way out is public education. And this governor and this legislature not only have not made that a priority, but they have begun the process of dismantling it.
Their rationale is that we were number 44 in the country in taxes, and we just were not attractive to business.
Well, certainly taxes are one of the issues that businesses look at when deciding to come to North Carolina or to expand in North Carolina. But they also look at quality of life. They look at public education. Most of the CEOs and other heads of companies are going to want to know where their kids are going to school and where their employees' kids are going to school and what kind of schools we have. We have had over the years a renowned public university system that is nationally known. We've had an excellent community college system. And if you start cutting the funding, and you got to make smart investments, obviously, but the cuts are to the bone at this point. And now we're going to lose some of that luster nationally, and it's going to affect our economy. It's going to affect jobs. We've got to stop the bleeding. We've got to make better decisions about how we're going to invest taxpayer money.
Governor McCrory says he turned down those tens of millions of dollars in federal Medicaid money and left. I think the latest report actually says it's over 300,000 now, is a more refined report, rather than 500,000. It's still hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians who couldn't be covered under expanded Medicaid. And the reason for that was the system was broken. We need to fix it before we expand it, and we're going to have to pay that money back anyway, so it's not really free money.
That's one of the worst decisions of the entire year. To turn down billions of dollars in federal money that's going to end up going to Arizona and Ohio and other states where Republican governors have decided to put public policy over politics. What you have here is the ability to help people who are working poor. I talked to a woman named Gail the other day who was working hard, $12, $13 an hour, was sick, had a child, was making a little too much for Medicaid. The expansion would have covered her and her family. Here we are boosting someone who's working hard, trying to make it. She now has more funding available for her and her family. But even if you don't agree with this issue on a moral basis, look at the economic development side. Look at the tens of thousands of jobs in the healthcare industry that this brings. Look at the billions of dollars in investment. You already have seen one rural hospital to close. They cited this issue. There are a lot of people talking to the governor and to the legislature about this decision and why we're turning it down. Unfortunately, I think it's politics because it has something tangentially to do with the Affordable Care Act. And therefore, if that's the case, then we're going to pick politics over good, sound public policy. What a bad idea. I hope they will reconsider it between now and the short session.
Roy Cooper, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Roy Cooper is the Attorney General of the state of North Carolina. Coming up next, the music of the Steep Canyon Rangers. Stay with us.